depending on the way you feel that you live. Dear landlord, please heed these words that I
Hi, this is John Boutte from New Orleans, Louisiana, and you're listening on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio. Keep on listening, baby.
Mosaic is proud to present the English Language Institute, located off of Commercial Broadway. Do you have trouble in English conversations? Our conversation class can help. Our experienced teachers give you the tools to have a smooth, natural conversation. In this class, you will learn conversational strategies, Canadian cultural awareness, and participate in dynamic speaking activities. For further information, visit mosaicbc.org/MELI, the Mosaic English Language Institute on Commercial Drive.
Thank you for tuning in to our third episode of ArtSpeak Radio Digest. And that music we were listening to was composed by Leif Hall. Thanks, Leif. Tonight, your host is me, Gabby Dow, and in the studio, I'm accompanied by our co-host, Eric Hood. Before we get started on this evening's program, we would like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting live from the studio, which is located on the unceded and occupied traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. We are thankful to live, work, and learn on and from these beautiful coastal lands as uninvited guests. ArtSpeak Radio Digest is collectively produced by a group of artists and writers, including Brady Cranfield, Emma Metcalf-Hurst, Autumn Schnell, and myself, with additional support from Bopa Chai and Eric Hood. ArtSpeak Radio Digest takes the form of an audio journal, with the new issue presented every Tuesday from 9 to 10 p.m. The project is an approach to thinking about ArtSpeak's extensive publishing program and also the community-driven model of Co-op Radio, ArtSpeak's neighbors here on the Downtown East Side. So last week, during our second episode, we listened to an introduction on the modus operandi of ArtSpeak Radio Digest by ArtSpeak's own director and curator, Bopa Chai. We also listened to an interview with artist Vanessa Brown and ArtSpeak's associate director, Eric Hood, on her recent exhibition with Michelle Helene McKenzie called Veils of the Bog. It opened at Western Front just a few weeks ago and featured an immersive installation of sculptural mobiles and cascading drones. We also listened to another interview between Bopa and artist Jen Wei of the collective Other Sites for Artists about their project, The Foreshore Listens, which kicked off last week, also at Western Front. And finally, we also listened to the second of Brady Cranfield's ongoing feature, Keywords for Vancouver. He spoke to activist, organizer, and Pollyanna librarian Vincent Tao about art washing, and how it encapsulates the relationship between the arts, funding, and the rapidly developing city of Vancouver. So moving on to this week's program, we will be listening to an interview between myself and visual artist, musician, publisher, filmmaker, and overall Renaissance woman, Casey Way, on this year's Wrong Wave, the sixth edition of the experimental and multidisciplinary Music Meets Art Festival, originally birthed by the former Helen Pitt Gallery back in 1984. Then we'll listen to a song called Hot Dog by Casey's band Kamikaze Nurse. Then we'll listen to Brady's Keywords for Vancouver with a very special guest, Jean Swanson, an anti-poverty activist, community organizer, and also city council candidate running for COPE in our upcoming civic election. And don't forget that advance voting takes place from October 10th to the 17th, and the actual election day is October 20th. There are 12 community centers that you can vote at, and you can vote at any of them. Finally, we'll be capping off our evening together with a selection of songs chosen by Eric Hood. They'll feature some recordings by some of our folks featured in today's episodes. And we're off.
Hello, my name is Casey Way, and I am a visual artist, musician, publisher, filmmaker, and this year's curator of Wrong Wave 2018, number 6. A little bit about Wrong Wave. What is it? And if you could describe Wrong Wave in a few sentences for us.
To me, Wrong Wave, it's an experimental music festival, and it's been going on since 1984, very intermittently. There's been 5 iterations, and this is the 6th one. And in the past, it's always been a focus on like experimental kind of other out there music practices that don't necessarily belong in other streams of music in the community. Yeah.
That being said, could you give us a few examples of programs and performances that we can expect for this year?
For this year, okay. Well, this year the festival is broken up into 3 days. Starting on Wednesday, October 10th, it's going to start with a film screening, and I don't believe there's ever been a film screening before, so that's really cool. So it's going to be at Vivo Media Arts Center, starts at 7 p.m., but if people want to come earlier, there'll be complimentary pizza for everyone. And the films that we're screening are Virgo Soundtrack by Miles Black and Art Rock, the Popular Esoteric by me. And these two films, I've been working on my film for like about 4 years, and it didn't start off with this intent to make a music documentary, but that's what it ended up as. And Miles has been working on his film. It's like continually being made. It'll never be finished. And he's been working on that for 2 years, and both are related to the music communities in Vancouver. So yeah. So that's Wednesday, the first night. And then Friday, October 12th, and Saturday, October 13th, will be 2 nights of music in the traditional Wrong Wave fashion. The first being at the new Redgate space on the 12th, and then at 8 East on the 13th.
Could you tell us a little bit more about how you came to curate this year's Wrong Wave?
Yeah, Kay Higgins from Unit Pit approached me and asked me if I wanted to. And my Art Rock series that ran for 2.5 years had just ended in April, at the end of April this past year, and I was just relieved, and I felt recharged and open to, you know, whatever would come of it from ending the Art Rock series, and this happened. So it's kind of like, for me, just a continuation of Art Rock, which is nice to reframe it in a different context, include some different elements, and move away from the structure that I had made for myself with the Art Rock series.
So for me, it kind of made a lot of sense when I found out you were curating Wrong Wave through your previous work of Art Rock. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a little bit more context of what Art Rock was, how long it ran for, and also how it kind of informs your artistic practice and your music practice overall?
The Art Rock series started, years are hazy now in my mind, but I believe it was in September 2016 that it started, and it was a monthly night at the Astoria Pub in the downtown east side, where I invited mostly people I knew, just like friends who I don't know if they would identify as, but I would identify them as both artists and musicians, to come perform music once a month. And it was pretty like low stress, everyone was kind of into it, and when I started I wasn't sure if anybody would be into it, but then it snowballed and kept itself going for like 2.5 years once a month. And I decided to end it. I mean, there was really no reason for me to end it other than the fact that I was getting pretty burnt out. But when Emily Carr, like Kate Armstrong and City Studio, they did that project, 10 Different Things, they invited me to do a public art project. I took Art Rock into the, really like took it into the public art realm, and framed it like that. So yeah, it kind of weaves into and out of an art practice, my art practice, but my art practice weaves in and out of itself as well too. So yeah, the funny thing about Wrong Wave though, it's like my former band Late Spring played it in 2014, and I didn't realize at the time, but now looking back, doing a little bit of research to come prepared for this interview, the Art Rock, the last Wrong Wave was in 2014, so 4 years ago, and it was called Art Rock ? And I didn't know that, but I guess things happen that way when you're not looking, and then your brain repurposes it and you know, uses it as your own original idea.
How you say that a lot of the performers that you would invite into to perform at Art Rock, you consider them this sort of blend of musicians and artists, but then you were also saying that a lot of themselves wouldn't consider them in that way. And it's really interesting for me, because for me personally, I'm also really interested in this intersection between visual art and music. I think there's a lot of things that make sense happening there. But for me, contemporary art seems very gatekeepy. It's something that you access through an education, an undergrad or a master's degree, whereas music is something that everyone else can enjoy. It feels more democratic for me in many ways. Is this kind of where your term popular esoteric comes from?
That's not how I like considered the term when I was first using it. I mean, it's totally like a real interpretation that makes sense to me as well. But when I came up with the idea of the popular esoteric, it was more thinking about more broadly like forms of popular culture that are used to sell this idea of freedom. But most of popular culture just seems so generic and thoughtless and uninteresting and not creative. And I can see a lot of talented, creative, you know, people making popular culture. But then when do you want something to be popular? Does it have to be kind of like washed out? And I don't want, I mean, of course I want whatever I do, whatever I want us all to do to be like embraced by the world, because I think we have like really good intentions and we're not trying to like sell anything, or we're not trying to like be famous, and we're not trying to, I don't know, like be the 1% or anything like that. We're just like making art and music in the way that I feel like it should be made, for the people, by the people. But there's just seems to be forces of capitalism or whatever governing the content, which is contentless, because we're not supposed to use it to think. So popular esoteric for me is taking the idea of taking popular culture as a medium back and empowering yourself with it again, because that's where I come from, I guess. When I was a preteen or a teen, those were the entry points for me to more like intellectual, philosophical, more art school things. So yeah, I mean, music and art, this kind of back and forth between what is accessible and what is being kept at a gate by professionals or educated people, that's in the popular esoteric too. And I think that, yeah, definitely contemporary art is gatekeepy, and music is and it isn't, and art it is and it isn't gatekeepy as well, but contemporary art definitely is.
Is this the first year that Wrong Wave has held screenings?
I think so. There's not much about Wrong Wave on the internet before the 2012 iteration that happened at the Waldorf, and that year was way more experimental, mm-hmm. like ambient dance techno music, electronic music, and not much, you know, art, rock music at all. And the one in 2014, they were performance based, no screenings. But I'm not sure what the first four Wrong Waves were like. I mean, there is this one article on the UniPid website about the first, very first Wrong Wave, and that was a very like punk night, it seemed, as the review like speak to. But yeah, I don't know. I think so. We'll have to corroborate that with Kay.
Right. Yeah, I was trying to do some research on the internet before this, but it was quite difficult to find information about Wrong Wave. But I think the sort of ephemera of the events is a part of its essence.
Yeah, and I think the screenings, I mean, that just is, there's a screening because it's serendipitously so. And I don't know if that needs to speak for larger trends or larger ways artists and musicians are making and disseminating their own work, but it does speak to our current moment right here for Wrong Wave number 6, I guess.
I hear laughter. Laughter is the getting its way out. Laughter is the getting its way out. Laughter is
So to return back to the screenings, there's two screenings, yours. Could you remind me of the title again?
Art Rock ? The Popular Esoteric.
And the second film is by Miles Black, and
yep.
That one was called
Virgo Soundtrack.
Could you give a sort of, for the Art Rock documentary, you were working on a project last year, I believe, at Unit Pit called Karaoke
Music Video Maker Free Store.
Did some of the material or some of the process of making that project go into this documentary, or did it, or was it also coming from documentation of the Art Rock series? Was that always a part of your plan to create a documentary, or was it something that just kind of came?
Oh, it's something, yeah, it's definitely something that came over time. First, with the Art Rock series, it was more in reference to the Scott and Gary show and TV party, with this idea of just in public access television, like the Winnipeg babysitter stuff that you can find on YouTube. I just wanted to make a TV show, but in our current moment, it would be a web TV series, and just like have each Art Rock be its own episode. And over the course of 2.5 years, it took a while for me to really figure out how to record sound in that space and how to mix it properly. So the first like year of footage looks great, but doesn't sound the best. And then from there on in, it started sounding as pro as it looked. And I think that's really important for me. I mean, as a musician who likes to, you know, perform in front of people and seeing when people video record what I'm performing, it would always be great to hear it as well as to see it. So I think that was a definite turning point in my own practice, where I became really way more comfortable sharing it with the world, and then kind of taking that and applying it in this more filmic way. And I didn't think about making a documentary until I saw the last music documentary that was made about Vancouver, No Fun City. And I just had problems with its narrative structure, and I wanted to make one that was more contemporary and reflected how I felt. And with all the footage I had collected, it wasn't difficult to just think like, oh, I can just go shoot at a few more locations, a few more DIY spaces that are getting shut down, a few more places where people are trying to make things and keep things happening, and then I would have like enough material to work from.
The 8 lashes of baby's breath. B is for pond, drinks a spray of baby's breath. 8 legs of baby's breath, blank pond and spooked apartment. Nailworm, family romance, smoke Spielberg, new gothic. The ashtray perfume, pale door, housefly arose. B is for black, mold, fades, peach, balloon, mushroom. F is for fate, foul, unfair, fog, and filthy air. Piss yellow sunshine, we hate it doesn't mean a thing. Sad, vague fever, palm at the end of the mind. D is for Dallas, I've never breathed its air. P is for probably, identified more with a piece of clothing than a character on the show. P is for puffy, sleeve, satin, burgundy, and fuchsia lips. S is for a show shot in Texas. Who shot Texas? Or later, I remember, it's who shot JR.
Maybe to kind of conclude our conversation, could you speak a little bit more about your publishing practice, Agony Club, and how that, I see it for me, again, because I know you as well and I've participated in your projects in various ways, for me it makes a lot of sense for you to kind of like distribute the sort of like material that you bring into the world via yourself or via like other people or collaborators, and publishing just makes so much sense. So on the 13th of October, mm-hmm. there's going to be a publication launch of Wrong Wave 666 at 8 East. Can you speak more about that publication?
Yeah, I totally forgot about it because there's just so much going on in this festival. The Wrong Wave 666 is an invitation I sent out to all the participating artists, performers, to contribute, submit to me their ephemera that they've held on to, collected, just haven't thrown away over the years. And that rain, I just put the call out. It could be anything. It could be like set lists, lyrics, tour diaries, flyers you've kept, doodles, any sort of research image or writing that has some meaning to you now. Maybe there's something you've forgotten about and won't include, but it can't be completely, you know, I guess, airtight in a tome or anything. I never think of what I make as zines, even though I don't mind when people call things I make zines at all, because it's a part of that culture, but I didn't grow up looking at zines at all. So I treat this as more of like a collage essay of things that people have given me upon my request, and creating some kind of like narrative that puts everyone's practice in conversation with each other. And yeah, that's what Agni Club is interested in doing, I suppose. Everything I do, I guess it's a little bit dark, it's a little bit earnest, but it's an extension of trying to create the space I want to exist in. So in a way, it's very selfish, but I feel like, I mean, at the Art Rocks and at the Wrong Waves and at, like, anything I do, it doesn't matter. And I sometimes feel bad because I'm like, maybe it matters to the people I'm asking to perform. Like, it doesn't matter to me if there's like 10 people there or like 60 people there or 100 people there. But just the fact that we're able to claim the space and to exist, I think that's really important for the people who don't come but who know that this thing is existing.
Is there anything else that you wanted to say about Wrong Wave on the radio?
No, just come out. Yeah, come to Vivo, eat pizza, come to the shows. They're all free or by donation. Like, if you want, buy a publication. They'll be, I think, $10 or pay what you can. I don't know, yeah. There's just a lot of cool things happening in the city, and that's been happening. So let's hope it happens for some time longer. Yeah.
And if people can't make any of the Art Rock days, will the publication be available online or maybe at a different venue?
It will be available at 8 East because they kind of serve as a retail store as well, and will mm-hmm. be available at Redgate because they have a storefront as well. And as always, just, I don't know, message me, or they'll be floating around, I think. Yeah.
Right. And the films. Mm-hmm. Will there, it's the world premiere of both films.
Yes.
Will there be another opportunity to see them if people miss?
I mean, probably. Miles is very chill about just, yeah, like, email him, and I'm sure he'll send you a link. And as for me, I can also send out links. Yeah. It's the internet. We can totally do it. But it's not the same as being there in person eating pizza.
Yes, yes.
You are listening to ArtSpeak Radio Digest on CFRO 100.5 on your FM radio dial, Vancouver.
So for those who have just tuned in, you're listening to ArtSpeak Radio Digest. That station ID was done by Corey Weingarten. Thanks, Corey. It's me, Gabby Dow, in the studio here tonight in good company with Eric Hood.
Good evening.
Hi, everyone. And we hope you're all having a great evening. Just to catch us all up, we listened to an interview I did with Casey Way, this year's curator of Wrong Wave No. 6, and a song called Hot Dog by her band Kamikaze Nurse. The interview was interspersed with excerpts from some of Wrong Wave's performers. In order of appearance, the excerpts were from Dashes, a sound collaboration between Elisa Ferrari and John Brennan with Jean-Philippe Antoine, Crotch from Nanaimo, Izzy Ford and Jeremy Van Wyck, and a poem by Tiziana Lamelia with sound support from Julian Howe. I'm personally feeling very excited to check out the Wrong Wave goings-ons, especially excited for 8 East, which is Unit Pitt's new location and is a joint endeavor with the New Orchestra Workshop Society. And again, that's happening Saturday, October 13th, doors at 8 p.m. and performances at 9 p.m. for the publication launch, the final event of Wrong Wave. And a big shout-out to Wrong Wave's performers, everyone behind the scenes, and of course Casey Way. And a hot civic election tip, Casey's band Kamikaze Nurse are selling hand-printed silkscreen cope t-shirts. You can grab them for $10, but I believe the run is limited. Eric Hood is actually modeling one in the studio right now. I wish you could see it.
It's slightly off-center, which makes it a little bit more back-end.
It's looking good. How's the cotton?
Feels nice and soft.
All right. So, yeah, you should get at them. I think I've seen this deal floating around on the internet. I think your best bet is to send them a message on their Instagram. I believe it is at Kamikaze Nurse. And so, without further ado, we'll move on to the second portion of our evening, which is Brady's latest keywords for Vancouver. It's the third part. And the last part in his series, which we play during the last two episodes of ArtSpeak Radio Digest. So the past two episodes, Brady sat down with Vincent Tao, the librarian at Pollyanna inside 221A, where they unpacked the term art washing. They teased out the ways that culture is frequently co-opted by development corporations. For example, in the case of the city of Vancouver, public art initiatives commission artists to create works alongside the development of luxury condos. And by doing this, they fulfill the minimum requirement set by civic legislation in order to move into and develop neighborhoods, using art as a sort of Trojan horse, hence art washing, pardon me. So in this third episode, in the third part of the series, Brady is sitting down with housing activists and Cope City Council candidate Jean Swanson. Here we go.
Hello. Welcome to Keywords for Vancouver with Brady Cranfield. It's a series of conversations about a set of interrelated issues that impact the social, political, and economic character of our city. In particular, it's also about how art production, presentation, and reception and the composition and activities of art's local communities fit into and affect that character. Tonight's conversation, the second in this series, is with poverty activist Jean Swanson, who is running for Vancouver City Council with a coalition of progressive electors, or COPE. The main topic is, the city we need. Let's go.
Okay, I'm Jean Swanson, and I'm running for City Council with COPE.
Kim, maybe you could tell me just a little bit about your background. And you're a well-known figure, and you know, I'm familiar with your long work in the downtown east side, but maybe give us a sense of some of the projects you've been involved in and things that you've done.
Okay, so when I started working in Vancouver, I was slinging beer at the Patricia Hotel.
Lovely.
Then I worked at the Downtown Eastside Residents Association with Bruce Erickson and Libby Davies in the 70s. And we worked on trying to get the standards of maintenance law written and enforced, the same one that isn't enforced today. And we work to get more and better housing and try and do what the low-income residents of the neighborhood want. And then I worked for the Hospital Employees Union for some years in the Solidarity Coalition. And then I helped form End Legislated Poverty, which was a BC-wide anti-poverty coalition. And around that time, I was active in organizing the peace marches that we had in the early 80s, the big peace marches. And then I also was later on co-chair of the Action Canada BC Network, which was an anti-free trade group, so I fought against the free trade deals. And I kept on in the anti-poverty movement, and I became the president of the National Anti-Poverty Organization for a while, and I wrote a book called Poor Bashing, The Politics of Exclusion. And I took some time off to take care of my grandson, and I started back volunteering at the Carnegie Community Action Project about 12 years ago, where we worked on getting more and better housing, stopping gentrification, and trying to get higher welfare rates in the downtown east side. And as part of all this, I've been involved with the city a lot. I'm up there bugging them a lot. I've been on the City Planning Commission. I've been on several local area planning committees. I've been to countless public hearings, and yeah, so I know quite a bit about City Hall and reports, and I know a lot of the staff, and I know the councillors.
And you once ran previously, I mean, last year
you
ran... Oh
yeah, my electoral history is last year I ran in the by-election and came in second, and I didn't do any politics for 30 years before that, but I did run for mayor against Gordon Campbell in 1988.
Boy, did we make the wrong choice. To think you could have had BC Place. Could have been your pet project. There's a lot of continuity then with your history and the current, let's say, platform for you and for COPE. Maybe you could kind of summarize the key points.
Okay, so we have a really integrated platform with COPE where we've integrated the council and the school and the park board platform, and we're going to make a really exciting announcement on Tuesday.
Ooh.
That shows that. But anyway, we've got great candidates too. At the school board, we've got Diana Day, who would be the first Indigenous woman who would be on school board, and Barb Parrott, who has been a teacher and was active in the BCTF. And on parks, we've got Gwen Giesbrecht and John Irwin, who are really fighting for making community centers and rec accessible to everyone. And then on council, we have Derek O'Keefe and Ann Roberts. Our platform, the big thing that we're pushing right now is a rent freeze, which means no 4.5% increase. So we got 2% knocked off that. So now it means no 2.5% increase. And more importantly, no increase to whatever the landlord wants when a tenant leaves. That's called vacancy control. We used to have it in the 70s. Mm. But because we don't have vacancy control, landlords have an incentive to evict, because if they evict someone, they can charge whatever rent they want.
Wow.
And this is making it so tenants basically have no security in Vancouver, especially long-term tenants. COPE really wants to protect tenants. And so if the province isn't going to give us a rent freeze, we're going to use every city power we possibly can to get it. Hmm. And that includes using the tenant relocation and protection policy, which we think we could change that to require the landlords guarantee tenants return at the same rent before they get an eviction or a renovation or a demolition permit.
Right.
And there's other things we could do with the business license, like require landlords to tell us what their rents are before they get a business license, things like that.
Right.
So we're committed to using every conceivable city power to protect tenants. The second thing is we want to end homelessness, like really end it, not just say we're going to end it and then have it get worse. Mm. And we're the one party that has a source of revenue to do that. We need an upfront source of revenue. So we're saying we need a mansion tax. So we tax the value of mansions over $5 million. And if we did that, we could get enough money within 1 year to build nice modular housing for all the counted homeless people.
Yeah. And this is the portion above $5 million too, right?
Yeah, it's just a portion. So if your house was worth $6 million, you'd only pay the extra tax on $1 million.
Right.
And So after the first year, then we'd start using that mansion tax revenue to build nice co-op and social housing for renters. Our goal is to try and get more and more housing outside of the market so it can be, so we can actually implement housing as a human right. You know, we say health care is a human right. So how do you actually implement the right to health care? You'd get it out of the market so it's public, so we have public universal health care. It isn't perfect by a long shot, but it's not bad. So for housing, same thing. We have to get it out of the market in order to implement housing as a human right. And we can have nice social housing. They have it in Vienna. They have it in lots of other places. Mm-hmm. I live in nice social housing. I live in a co-op, and it's really nice.
Yeah, me too.
So the rent freeze, the ending homelessness, the mansion tax, and using that revenue to build lots of nice social housing, making housing a real human right. That's our main housing platform. Then we have other things to try and make other things affordable, like we want to work towards free transit.
Oh, awesome.
Starting with kids and low-income people. And this will, of course, have an effect on carbon emissions, which will be good. And we want to do things in the democratic arena. We want a ward system.
Mm-hmm.
We want people who are permanent residents to be able to vote. There's been a city report that's already recommended that. There's over 60,000 permanent residents in Vancouver. They work here. They pay taxes here.
Mm-hmm.
They should be able to vote here. A lot of them are working on my campaign.
You have 60,000 people working on your campaign?
Well, not 60,000, but a lot of people who are permanent residents are working on our campaign.
Yeah.
Yeah, we definitely need a ward system, because trying to reach 630,000 people takes a lot of money, and it's pretty impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the opioid crisis.
Yeah.
It has to be a huge priority, because so many people are dying, and it's just atrocious that Trudeau has signed this thing that Trump proposed about the war on drugs.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So the war on drugs is actually a war on people who are poor and people who have been abused and people who have suffered trauma. And we need to end the war on drugs. We need to make drugs legal. We need to provide treatment on demand for people who want it.
Mm-hmm.
And the council has to be a really, really loud voice for this. And it has to support people who are working on this and who are maybe even inching outside the law to do it, like some of the harm reduction folks have had to do in the past.
Right, yeah.
We want to also reduce the police budget and take some of that money that's spent on policing, especially the money that's spent on criminalizing poor people, and put it into services for them.
It's very depressing and demoralizing to see the, you know, the police and the state sort of working against, you know, even like the most basic level of care.
Yeah, I know. I was recently arrested for the Kinder Morgan thing, and I spent 4 days in jail. And I'm sure everybody actually said that they were all treated better because we were there. There were five of us Kinder Morgan folks in the Alouette prison for women. But it was so sad because if we had a good drug policy and a good housing policy and a good policies about ending poverty, I think they could take the fence down and turn that jail into a resort.
Yeah, they're interconnected. And I mean, this is
they're
always
really connected.
The,
yeah.
Two follow-ups. And first, I want to ask just a kind of historical thing. Has Vancouver ever had a ward system?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I know I was fighting for one when I worked at Dura in the 70s.
Right.
We had a map. We had all the wards drawn. We had 12 wards and everything. And we had a vote on it, and it was 57%, but at that time, four wards.
Mm.
But at the time, the law said we needed 60%.
So, oh, great.
Yeah.
Oh, well. The other question is, you mentioned this idea of the Vienna model.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of the profile and the idea of the Vienna model was elevated by the participation of some local artists, the Urban Subjects Project of Sabine Bitter and Jeff Dirksen and Helmut. And curious about, you know, your thoughts about that, and it maybe lead us into talking about the relationship between the arts in Vancouver and some of the politics that we're discussing.
So I saw the exhibit that Sabine and Jeff brought from Vienna It was at the Vancouver Museum.
That's right.
And, of course, the thing that strikes you is that the housing, the social housing in Vienna is so nice. You know, yeah. There's swimming pools yeah. and community centers. And they evidently have competitions among architects to design the places.
They're not just fighting for beauty, in other words?
Of course, as a co-op resident myself, I know that you can have nice social housing. And
mm-hmm. I can't remember who it was who said, comparing the North American kind of obsession with ownership, contrasting it with the kind of the European model, I guess it would be exemplified by maybe Vienna, of like these long-term rentals, like almost like lifetime leases and co-ops yeah. and things like this. This is just a totally different way to organize your social system.
Yeah.
Yeah. And why does it seem so inconceivable here? Is it, I mean, the market just... Just drives
market
everything.
Rules, but not for long if we have anything to say about it.
That's what I want to hear. How does the modular housing fit into this mixture? What is your feeling about that? Just recently in the space earmarked for the supposedly the new Vancouver Art Gallery has had like a fast installation of modular housing.
So I just went and saw the one that's by the Olympic SkyTrain station.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's 320 square feet units, which is bigger than some of them. Like one by the golf ball is only 250. It has big fridges. It has a beautiful community kitchen. Everybody has their own bathroom. And that one is in a really good site. It's in Falls Creek, right? So people can walk right down to the water, and it's right next to the SkyTrain station.
Yeah.
The other thing is, it was built in 9 weeks.
I know.
Yeah. 9 weeks.
Yeah.
We could put every homeless person in one of those
yeah.
in a year
yeah.
easily
yeah.
if we had the political will. It is so doable.
Mm-hmm.
So, so, so doable. We can do it. It'll save lives. It'll save money in the long run because it costs so much to keep homeless people on the street. All the studies show that.
Yeah.
People can turn their lives around if they have a little bit of security. We just have to do it only. I would say they should be permanent, not temporary.
Mm-hmm.
You can build them permanent. All you have to do is put a foundation in.
Right.
And let's do it.
Exactly. Let's do it. Yeah. Yeah.
There's no excuse not to, really.
Yeah.
What excuse can you think of not to do it?
I can think of many bad excuses. I can't think of any socially responsible excuses. Yeah, it's shameful. It really is. And maybe I could get your opinion on this. If just today I saw that David Eby is going to do a big news conference about the money laundering in real estate. So, you know, the NDP is a mixed bag and seem inconsistent with their commitments and their politics, but kind of admire David Eby's work in this area. But clearly, it's all connected in a very specific way. And I'm just curious, was there at some point a noticeable shift towards the monetization and commercialization and, I guess, financialization of housing away from other kind of provincial money-making stocks like lumber or things like this, like from a resource economy to one based on land? Because, it seems like the short history of the kind of developer-driven politics at
yeah.
The provincial and city level is kind of coming to an end. And with, this David Eby yeah. announcement that is impending, it's probably going on while we're speaking right now, talking about money laundering in real estate. It seems like a lid is being lifted off. And I was just interested in two things. One is, this idea of remembering when there wasn't condos, which suggests that maybe, the BC economy was organized differently and there was a deliberate shift to real estate as like an engine of the economy, which is falling apart. And the other is, do you see some new opportunities with this kind of shift at the provincial level and maybe even like the fact of Gregor leaving?
Well, I definitely see a shift or I wouldn't be running.
Yeah.
I think that there's hope. I mean, some of it is from like Bernie Sanders and Kishama Sawant, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Where people who say what's really needed are getting resonance with the public. Another thing for Vancouver is that tenants are now a majority.
Right.
It wasn't so long ago that tenants couldn't even vote. Now they're the majority, and I think politicians have to start protecting tenants, listening to tenants, doing what's good for tenants. It doesn't mean ignoring everybody, but tenants have to become a priority. Also, because tenants are generally lower income than owners. Mm. And then this thing with getting developer money out of civic politics, that's good. Although there's some loopholes that still need to be closed. I'm hoping the government will do that.
Mm.
And I'm hoping that EB will do the other things that need to be done in terms of dealing with crime and casinos and things like that.
Yeah.
I think that would be good. And other things, like I just read that Raymond Louis is trying to get a job with the developer organization.
Nobody could have seen that coming.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
You see, the city has the power of rezoning, and zoning is a huge, huge, huge power that a lot of people don't even know about it. It means the city can sign a piece of paper and say that you can double or triple or make your profits tenfold just by saying you can build a 10-story building on this instead of a 1-story building on this little parcel.
Yeah.
And that's a huge power, and that's why developers usually put their money into city elections, and why it's good that we have a law that they aren't supposed to do that now. We'll see if they've found ways to do it.
Mm.
Our campaign, of course, doesn't take money from developers or corporations.
Yeah, good. So, you know, in talking about the developers, I'm sure you're fully aware that the handful of these major developers are big arts philanthropists. They fund museums and schools and have endowments and are art collectors and, you know, kind of participate in the art market at a, you know, international level, but also have a kind of significant impact locally. So help me pick apart, if it's possible, this relationship to this kind of money that clearly is feeding into the undermining of the, you know, the kind of integrity of the city, the livability of the city, but at the same time, it's kind of propping up and supporting the arts.
I always say to friends of mine that are artists that I've always been a low-income person myself, and there's friends that have made things that I would have loved to buy, but I can't because I don't have enough money that would actually compensate them for their time.
It's
so they usually end up giving me stuff, which is amazing. But anyway, so there has to be a lot more public support for the arts. I know we have a lot of artists working in our campaign. If you look at our signs, you can tell.
Yeah. Shout out to Maddie.
Maddie and Bev Ho and Deirdre from Four Sisters. They've done amazing banners and posters, and they've done skits, and they made a giant Kleenex box, which they called Genex, out of a van where we launched my campaign in the Crescent, surrounded by mansions. And the idea was, if mansion owners didn't want to pay the mansion tax, they could wipe their tears with these giant Kleenexes.
Yeah, well, they'd have so many tears, and they need big ones. Yeah.
So artists need places to live, and artists need places to work, and they need somebody up there on council that's going to support that. Artists are usually renters, and there's so many artists that have been evicted from the downtown east side, from the workspaces.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
This is, I think, the point that I'd like to make and see how you feel about this, that above and beyond special kind of policies for artists, like art-specific policies, even in the case of funding, which, you know, can always be improved, and anything that could drive us away from relying on these, like, you know, developer philanthropists, in my opinion, is a good thing. But it seems like the core of your political objectives directly are beneficial to artists, as you're just describing, because we are the renters, we are the, you know, the precarious employees, we are, you know, would stand to benefit from a transformation at that level. That's going to help us, you know, be able to develop our practices and our community, it seems to me, like, you know, in a very direct way.
And we're hoping that for businesses or, you know, storefronts in commercial areas, that we can have some sort of, not just have progressive tax for residents, but to have progressive tax for businesses. So if there was an artist studio that wasn't, you know, Walmart's or Canadian Tire or something, that they would be paying a lower rate, a lower tax rate than the big ones.
Right. So, you know, making it easier for artist organizations to you know, found themselves and grow and develop and work with their community.
And not having to pay taxes based on the highest and best use if an area is upzoned.
Right.
Well, I'm just thinking the more I'm in this campaign, like yesterday I was at the rally for the Berkeley Tower where John Stovell, who's a local gentrifier, and he's renovicting a whole building. It's 10 stories tall or more even. And there were so many people at that rally from the West End who are being renovicted. Mm. So many people who are being renovicted. And they're being renovicted because of the West End community plan, which allows higher density buildings to go in.
Right.
So we've just got to adopt this policy that before any upzonings, we have to protect the tenants. And it would include duplexing too.
Yeah.
Because that's going to affect thousands of tenants.
Mm-hmm.
If it's more profitable for you to sell a strata apartment on your single-family lot than it is for you to rent a basement, you might do that. And what happens to the person that's renting the basement?
Yeah, yeah. Oftentimes an artist or a student.
Yeah.
Well, so when should we vote?
So the election is on October 20th, and the advance poll starts on the 10th. And there's a few places where you can do advanced polls. One of them is City Hall, but there's probably one in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
You can go to vancouver.ca elections and find out where the closest place is.
Awesome. And your website?
VoteCope2018.ca.
Perfect.
And Ann Roberts, Derek O'Keefe, Diana Day, Barb Parrott, Gwen Giesbrecht, and John Irwin. Those are our COPE candidates.
And Jean Swanson.
Oh, yeah, me too. So there's 178 candidates running. The ballot is ridiculous.
Oh, my God, 178.
There's only 7 candidates that are going to go for a rent freeze, and they all have COPE after their name.
Right.
So just look on the ballot for COPE and put a mark by those folks.
Yeah, let's make some change. Thanks a lot.
Okay, you're welcome.
This has been Keywords for Vancouver with Brady Cranfield. See you next week.
CFRO 100.5 Vancouver.
Hey, so thanks again for listening. That was Brady Cranfield's Keywords for Vancouver, his interview with Jean Swanson. And I know I promised we were going to listen to some of the performances from Wrong Wave, but we are unfortunately running out of time, so I'm going to quickly go through our bulletin report. So this week, Reading Indigeneity in Comics with Cole Pauls was happening at 236 East Pender Street, and there will be a second part of that happening on October 16th in the same location. Tomorrow night at Deep Blue, there are performances by Raven Shekhan and Mel Padgett. I'm really excited for that, and perhaps I'll see you there. The following night is an opening of The Flower Smeller, a solo show by Steve Hubert at Malaspina Printmakers Society. And that same night is also an opening, Stalactite, a solo show by Dorothy Cross at Libby Leshgold Gallery. Next week we'll have an interview with Carmen Papalia, which I'm also really excited about that. He's an activist and artist, and a few of us were very fortunate to attend a panel between him and a few other people called Disrupting Barriers in the Area of Accessibility. So tune in next week and we will cover some of that. Thanks for listening.
The Community Radio Fund of Canada, CRFC, funding program The Radio Matrix was founded in 2012. It aims to improve local programming and volunteer participation. Since its inception, it enabled a total investment of more than $12 million in the campus and community radio sector. Vancouver Co-op Radio CFRO 100.5 FM is pleased to announce that almost $50,000 will go toward the implementation of the Youth Outreach Project. This is the 12th time that the CRFC provides financial support to Co-op Radio under various programs, bringing the total awarded to almost $263,000. The funds received will be put toward the recruitment of youth programmers to provide sustainable volunteer participation to CFRO radio show collectives. The Youth Outreach Coordinator will be responsible for developing and implementing online, on-air, and in-person volunteer recruitment strategies to attract a steady flow of new programmers to the station. For more information about Co-op Radio and the Youth Outreach Project, please visit coopradio.org.
Zombies on me, hit the plug on the iPhone. Check the time, cause I'm lost between the times.